session number 12811, reel 5.
Mr. Cannon, reel 5.
Captain Agar, he took a wide berth of the sinking. We picked up no survivors. The reason being that the lookouts had also reported having seen a submarine. And with hindsight, they were correct, because the UA and the U-60A were being fueled by the Python when we came on the scene. Well, they'd crash-dived. And strangely enough, the Python also had some of the survivors from the one of the other German raiders that had been sunk by the Devonshire. We weren't displeased about this. When they said that there were submarines, we thought at first, I wonder why he's not picking survivors up, you know, because it was usual to pick survivors up. But he said, no, there's submarines there. And we found out afterwards that as soon as we were out of sight, the submarine surfaced and took the actual survivors in tow. We sailed for the Cape, and as usual, we received all the hospitality that the people there could give us. They looked after us and our welfare. Then we took another convoy. This was the WS-12X, and this was one for Bombay. We took it up to Bombay, and it was a terrible place as far as I was concerned. I never did like India. I didn't like Trincomalee. I didn't like Colombo. I didn't like Bombay. It was a filthy, smelly place. And we took provisions on there, and we made the mistake of using their baskets to bring the supplies in, to swing them in. Big, like open wicker baskets they had. And of course, one of the worst things you can do is to use wicker baskets in those faraway places, because they were absolutely bug-lined. And we brought the baskets inboard, and within days we were bug-infested ourselves. And it got to alarming proportions. We had to de-louse the ship, and all the mess tables had to have underneath had to be gone over with a blowtorch. It was about this time that I was finishing passing from a leading seaman. I was very young. I had jumped the gun. I had been promoted able seaman 6 months before my time, instead of waiting the full year. I'd been promoted 6 months. My part one, Captain Agar had sent for me and congratulated me on my part one, remembering me possibly from when I was also on the bridge previously. And then I was doing part two. I finished part two, and although at that time I was only an able seaman, I was taking boats away, training hostility-only people in sailing. And I always remember one boat when we were in Bombay, I took away a cutter. And these lads I took away, hostility only, were supposed to have training. Training should have gone to an petty officer instructor. Because I'd been a Ganges boy, because I'd been sailing at the Ganges, because of my record, and because of the work I was doing and I was going through for leading seamen, I got the job of taking these away. And on one particular time, they said you're to take a whaler away with these hostility only lads in. So I said, fair enough. And it turned out really wonderful for me, because they didn't know the full technology, like check sheets or let fly sheets or stuff like this. So I had to explain to them in layman's terms, when I say to do something, I'll explain it later to you, but when I tell you to do something, I want you to do it immediately, you see. So they agreed on this. Got them in the boat, and very carefully we stepped the mast. It was a Montague-rigged whaler. We stepped the masts, and I explained to them that we had to spring the boat away from the side. We had to miss the boom, and we had to give it a good push, because in that time then we had to get the sails set to get way on, otherwise we'd come crashing into the ship's side. And of course, because it was free afternoon, we got the decks lined, everybody looking over the guardrails watching, including officers on the quarterdeck, watching these hostility only, people make a fool of themselves, you see. And like I said to them, you do your best, never mind about these people thinking that you're idiots, you know, you can do it. And it went like a gem. The bowmen pushed off, there was slight current there which pulled the bows away, and we went away, we missed the boom by only inches maybe, our sails set, and we got river, it was easy. Got them sat down in the boat, came flying past the cruiser again, you see, and so on and so forth, and of course it was all going on my record, you know, a good, we used to call them red inks, you're getting red inks for this.
And this is a good report.
A red ink. And when we brought it back, I said, now this is the worst part. It's like landing an airplane. It get taken off and landing is the worst part. I said, come in alongside. We do not want banging and so on, so on, so on. I said, now when I say let fly sheets, I want you and you just to let those ropes go. Let them go. That's what I mean. I said, because I'll just have to judge enough way on the boat to take us alongside. And when we do, I want you to grab on and grab on damn tight, you see. Yes, they would. It went perfectly. We came alongside. We didn't even touch the paintwork. We lowered them, we stored our canvas, and when I got inboard, there was a party waiting, arranged for the boat to be hoisted, had her hoisted inboard and stowed. Bosun sent for me, said, very well, son, did very, very well. I finished then, for passing for leading seaman, I finished part two. The sailmaker, who I said was a neighbour of ours at home, was also a friend of the warrant gunner, Mr. Hancock. When I finished part two, was the rigging, all wires, hawsers, you had no breaking strains, working strains, every hawser, shackle, everything in the ship. But I knew them because I'd lived with them, you see. And they sent for me, the sailmaker said, I've had a word with Hancock. He said, you've done very, very well in your part two. He said, you'll be picking it up fairly soon because they're short of trained personnel. They were desperately short at the time of trained personnel. So I said, fine, that's great. And then the divisional officer sent for me. He said, you do know that you'll be, when you pick up leading seamen, that you will have at least a 12-month period before you can go think of going in for petty officer. So I said, oh yes, I know that. He said, well, he said, what has been decided, he said, if it's agreed with you, that when you pick up your leading seaman's rating, that you will take up then temporary acting petty officer before you sit your exam. So I said, oh, that's strange. Then he said, yeah, it means that you'll possibly be a no badge petty officer, which is as low, it's as early as you can get. But I got everything going for me from when I was a training ship boy, you see. And I said, that's fine. He said, so everything was right. He said, it has to be ratified. And then everything, part one had been ratified. Part two wasn't ratified when we were sunk. You see? And when I got back to Durban, eventually, they sent for me, said, part two wasn't ratified, but would you just go in, go through the doors, and they know your case history and all that, because it's officers that they serve with and so on. It's just a matter of formality. I said, no. And they couldn't believe it. They said, what's wrong? I said, I don't want it anymore. They said, but it's only formality. I said, yeah, I know it's only formality, but I don't want it. And they had me in a report. And I said, I don't want it. The light's gone out. I do not want promotion. And I didn't.
Why not?
I just didn't. I'll tell you in a minute why I didn't want it. It was the way that I was treated after the Dorsetshire was sunk. It was disgusting. People would never, ever believe it. I'll tell you. And I didn't want it. And they tried everywhere. They tried me back in the barracks. And I said, no, I do not want it. And my father had been told by the sailmaker who was a survivor, got home. Well, he said, he'd been made up to petty officer. He would have been... And my father assumed I'd been made, and everybody assumed. And Fred Ball, who was a chief PO, he used to say, I'll never learn that seamanship manual like you. And I said, it's a piece of cake. All you've got to do this and this is, you know. And he could never understand. And all my colleagues could never understand, because the way I had it going, the minimum I could have wished for was warrant rank. I'd take no, anything that I'd sat for, even when I was at the train ship, I'd taken it and won it. And I can only put it down to bloody mindedness. Anyway, to digress. We were back again on convoying, and we were reputed to have got the last convoy away from Singapore. And we sailed as fast as we could out to Singapore, as it was falling at the time. And this convoy, they reckon, was the last had got out of Singapore, but was south of Singapore, and we had to go and find it. And we got off Surabaya, and then north of Surabaya we found this convoy, and it was women and children. And they reckoned, and there was a submarine being towed, and there was a damaged destroyer. They didn't want to leave them in the hands, and these were being towed. I can't remember the merchant ship that was in charge of the convoy. I thought it was the Manchester or City of Manchester, but I'm not sure about this. Anyway, we got the convoy, we collected it, and we brought it back to Colombo. And possibly being involved with that convoy saved us from the same fate, maybe as the Exeter and the other people later in the there. In between times, we had taken in parties of commandos into Burma, but we never brought any out. We never brought anybody out. We'd collect maybe from one of the African ports a consignment of soldiers. They never discussed it, they were kept separate from us, and that we never saw them. And then we'd land them in Burma, just let them go, and then we'd come away from there. Just convoying went on, it went on and on, and then we were in Colombo for a refit. We didn't know that the Japanese under Nagumo and Ozawa were intending on coming into the Indian Ocean. I think the hierarchy, the people in higher places knew, but as far as we were concerned, you know, we were just on normal, we were going out normal patrols again. Bit of a panic on. And we left Colombo with the Cornwall on the 4th of April. And we were supposed to rendezvous with the Far Eastern Fleet at the time. And at this time, I was in the after director. In between times, I moved around various other parts of the ship as part of me overall training as part of the ship. On Easter Sunday, April the 5th, we were sailing to rendezvous with the fleet just before lunch. We were spotted by an observer plane from the Japanese heavy cruiser, the Tone. We went to action stations. We thought at first that maybe it was just an isolated plane and that we'd get away with it. But we went full alert when we spotted another one. And we knew then that we weren't getting Easter eggs this Christmas, you know. And I always remember, I was up, right up in the after director, right at the top, and I had the door open because of the heat. I cut my leg out, and I take my gas mask off, and my life belt, and I'd hung it up behind me. Why I ever left two ships and never took my life belt with me, I don't know. But I'd hung my life belt and my gas mask up at the back of me here, because very, very hot up there it was. And I was there, and suddenly I saw this plane come down. And I couldn't believe it for a minute, because the Cornwall was astern of us. And I was looking back at the Cornwall, and that was the first bomb I know now that dropped, because I saw it come off, go down, didn't hit the Cornwall, but came down near under her bows. But as that was happening, so we got a full alert. And I slammed the door shut, put all the clips on. Why, I don't know, because we're heavy armament in the after control, and we would have been useless, the main armament. It would have been up to the pom-poms and the 4-inch, you see. The AK-AK armament on the cruisers was inadequate, totally inadequate. It had never kept pace with the development of naval aircraft, and especially the Japanese aircraft. It had never kept pace from way back in the 30s and 20s. We had the only additions that the Admiralty allowed us were two Horican guns, which we'd picked up in Colombo. And one was on the quarterdeck, and one was somewhere else, forward. I don't know where that one was, but the one on the quarterdeck. The next thing we knew, the whole ship, as I closed the door, the ship erupted. And almost immediately, we were getting hotter and hotter. I was like being in a steam bath. And the chief said, evacuate. And he said to me, you go down and help them on the pom-poms. And he detailed, as we opened the door, everything was ablaze. And what had happened, one of the first bombs had come ahead of us, just in front of us, and hit the small arms magazine and the aircraft, the Walrus. And of course there's fuel and everything there, and the whole lot had gone up in a flame. I got out, started to go down the ladder, and all this wire fell on me. It must have been aerial wire of some kind, I don't know what it is. And I kept thinking, good God, and I kept thinking, trying to get it off me. And for years after, I had little white marks where this damn stuff has. I got down the ladder. Man, I was mature by this time. I felt like an old man. I was 19 then, you see. I thought I'd been about at 19 years of age. I got down the ladder. I went on the pom-pom deck. And I was speechless. I went to the poor pom-poms. And the guns and the men were just like in a ball. As if a giant had got hold of them and screwed them up.
You mean welded together?
Oh, it had just gone. Something had gone, as if it distorted so badly. Where it hit. They were just distorted, as if somebody had got hold of them and screwed them up. Krosky was the petty officer, what they call captain of the gun. And he had gone round the other side. Krosky, he's still alive today, funnily enough, although he's still got shrapnel in him. And he found pieces of his men hanging around various parts of the rigging. But the fella I met, where I was called Cannon, he was called Cannon. No, it was a name like Cannon. I always remember a big chap, and I said to him, I've come to help you. It's a stupid thing to say, and he just said, what with that? And they'd gone. I think one or two still alive on the other side. And suddenly somebody shouted to me, Horlicken. So that was on the quarterback. So I said, right, and I was going to help him. And I started to run, and that's when somebody shouted my name. And I turned, and this lad, I reckon he had no arms and legs, practically. It was a Tom Murtagh, or Murta as he pronounced it. He'd been a Ganges boy, he'd been a champion boxer, and he was a strong, powerful lad. He was a terrific fighter. He was a real good boxer, this lad. And he shouted my name. I couldn't believe it. I mean, he was just a mass of blood. And he was just collapsed on death. And everything was blood. And I said to him, "Is that you, Murtagh?" He said, "Yeah." "Don't leave me. Don't leave me." That's all he could say. I said, "Hang on, nobody's going anywhere. I've got to go on the Horlicken to help load the Horlicken." And as the smoke passed like that, you could see the bombers. And I was amazed how low they were coming. It was as if they were diving lower and lower and lower. And you literally could see the bombs on clipping from underneath. Because they were single bomb. They were like an undercarriage they had. And you could actually see them as it came, you know, when the smoke parted. Everywhere was in a mess. The surgeon commander had got caught just far to me, and they'd nearly cut him in half with machine gun bullets. See? There was dead everywhere. And of course there was a lot of banging going on, because obviously there's a lot of men were trapped between decks, you see. And I thought, my God, no life belt again. It was still hung up, wasn't it, in the director. So I said to Tom Murtagh, I said, because he'd been a boy yet with me, like on the boys' mess deck, I said, "Nobody's going anywhere, but listen, you stay right there." And there was no going to be trying to move him, because he was just a bloody mass, you see. And he wasn't just him, there was stacks of them, but he was one I knew. And as I'm going over, then down they come again. And I always remember skidding along the deck and going right in under the barbette of X turret as the next lot exploded. I nipped out from there, jumped out down on the quarter deck, and went to the Horlicken. And I said to the chap in he strapped in. It was one of these lightweight guns, you know, not doing like this Horlicken, with like a magazine on top of ammunition. I said, "Where's your loader?" He said, "There." There was just a body there, you know, it was rolling, you see. So I said, "Oh, right." I said, "Well, I've come to load for you." He said, "Right." And all I did, got the magazines off the thing where they were stored, and as he just pointed his gun up in the air, I said, "Have you shot any down?" He said, "Not one. Not one." And he was just firing into the air. Well, as you looked around, you realised just there was just bodies rolling on the deck. And she was tilting and tilting. And there was bodies everywhere. It was a bloodbath. And blood was running everywhere. There was men absolutely butchered everywhere along the upper deck. Anyway, somebody said, "That's abandoned ship," just sounded. So I said to this lad, Grimes he was called, from Liverpool. I said, "Scouse, it's time to go." He said, "Right." So I unclipped him, because he was clipped in the harness. He was firing up in the air. He wasn't hitting damn all. And we were actually the last gun to fire. Everything else was silenced by then. And he was still firing. And that was the last gun. They'll still tell you, the last gun was the Horlicken on the quarterdeck firing. And it was myself and this scouse lad. Tilted up, I said to him. So we went up, we jumped in the water. Again, I thought, my God, we've done this before. And she was easing ahead slightly. She still hadn't gone down. She was still actually on the move. The mast snapped. She'd gone over and the mast broke away after, which was a big lifesaver for a lot. But we jumped into the water, we looked around and we found a piece of stuff that was floated. They were grabbing. You were grabbing anything that was coming off the deck to float, you see. Two boats got away again on that. One was a skiff, if I remember, and I think one was a whaler. One was a small boat and one was a whaler, which normally the rowing crew for a whaler is about 5 or 6, so you can imagine it doesn't carry a lot of whaler. It's only a thin boat. They got away, but they were a long way from where we were. So I said to this lad, I said, "Well, best thing we can do is to start swimming towards the main lot." So he said, You're right. Okay. So we started swimming and pushing between us. You know, he had a bit and I had a bit. And we were pushing, trying to keep it afloat. I thought, well, this is even better than the Courageous Leaves. I've got something to hang on to. And I said to him, you know, if ever we get out of this, Scouse, I said, no matter where we are, no matter what the conditions, we'll just drop what we're doing and we'll go and have a night on the town. He said, you're on. You're on. He said, that's a promise. I did. I met him years later. I was coming through Crewe and I had to change trains at Crewe and I was on my way back to Devonport. And as I got out of the train, I spotted him on the platform and I dropped my hammock and kip bag and I went hairing up to him and I said, you remember that promise? And he said, oh, good God, after all these years. I said, right, come on, we're on the town. I said, I don't mind being late back if you don't mind. And he held his hand up. He was chained to two naval policemen. I said, oh, God, no. He said, my mother was ill and they wouldn't give me leave to go home and see her. He said, so I went. He said, I'm just finished jail and I'm just going back now, he said, to finish off down Plymouth, you see. So I said to the patrol, I said, can you let him off just for an hour? I said, the circumstances, the bloke says, more than my life's worth. I never saw him again, so I don't know what happened to him. So I did meet him, but under very funny circumstances, old Scouse. Anyway, we got in the water and we made along, and then I came across a young petty officer called Krosky. And that's the reason he throws his arms around me every year and starts crying. And I saw him in the water and he was in bad shape. He'd got shrapnel and goodness knows what in him. And I said to Scouse, he's not going to last long here. And we felt young tigers, really, you know, we felt, you know, nothing was going to stop us. So I got hold of this chap and dragged him onto the top of this. You see, there wasn't all that much flotation in it, but just pulling him on it like this and pushed him. And actually, I stayed with him for 33 hours. And I never got my head out of the water in 33 hours. And I had to try to sleep, holding on with my fingertips, you know, this type of thing. And the oil wasn't very helpful either. We were covered in oil. And eventually, in the water, I got separated from the Liverpool lad, but stayed with Krosky on this thing. And eventually we made our way gently over the day towards this main crowd. They were obviously there well before us, before we came up on them. And in the night, I was trying to... Oil was lapping up under my chin, you know. I'd love to have been able to get out of the water if I possibly could, but it was just lapping up and that... And the thing about it was very hot by day and bitterly cold at night, you see. And every so often, what you had to do is, you'd be talking to somebody and you realised that it was a corpse. So you had to query first whether it was a corpse or not, because I found myself talking to somebody like, you know, and then found out it was a dead body, see. And they were floating, not flat, they were floating like upright, these. What we had to do, then we decided that every now and again we got hold of all the deadies and we passed them back and we pushed them to the outer edges as much as we could, because somebody said there were sharks about.